In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
If I were to ask you how you can tell that something's a political advertisement, I'm pretty sure I can guess where your brain would go.
A message from the Government of Canada.
This life-saving information is brought to you by this station and the New York City Fire Department.
A message from the Government of British Columbia.
I'm Hillary Clinton, and I approve this message.
What you might not mention, though, is looking for a specific hashtag at the end of a long Instagram post from a local mommy blogger. And that's kind of the point. In recent weeks, an Ontario Crown Corporation has been hiring Instagram influencers to help get its message out to the public. And sure, government corporations pay for communications all the time. But these influencers aren't being paid to instruct the public about a new service or remind them to get a flu shot or show them how to renew their license. They're being hired to speak favorably of a controversial transit proposal that is still in front of the public. So is this fair game? TV and radio are filled with commercials that feature ordinary people backing one government plan or another. So why should social media be any different? Even if that's true, though, how do we apply a set of rules made for mass media to a medium based on supposedly authentic one-on-one communication? Well, and also, do we even know if this strategy works? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Ben Spurr is the transportation reporter at the Toronto Star. Hello, Ben.
Hi.
I guess why don't you start, because people across Canada listen to this podcast, by explaining what Metrolinx is.
So Metrolinx is a crown corporation of the provincial government, and it's in charge of transportation planning and some operations in the Toronto area.
How does it interact with the TTC, for instance, or Toronto City Council and the metropolitan area?
Yeah, there's some overlap in kind of responsibilities. Metrolinx owns, for instance, the fare card system that the TTC and some other municipal transit agencies use. And so it's kind of an umbrella organization that is of a higher level of government than the TTC, for instance. So it kind of has some jurisdiction over kind of anything that happens with transit in Toronto.
What are their current plans for transit in Toronto? What are they trying to do?
So back in April, Premier Ford introduced a big $28.5 billion transit plan that was consisted basically of four different projects. And the central project that the Premier calls the crown jewel of the plan is the Ontario Line, which is a really long, about 15.5-kilometer line that would stretch from one end of the city to the other, cut through downtown. And then there's some other basically extensions of existing lines. So a Scarborough extension, an extension of the subway system deeper into Scarborough, an extension of the Yonge subway north into York region, and then an extension of the Eglinton West LRT towards the Pearson Airport. So four big projects that cost a lot of money.
Can you give us a sense of how long these or more likely other projects have also been in the works, and what the kind of culture around public transit in the greater Toronto area is?
Yeah, I mean, the Premier's announcement back in April kind of marked yet another sort of resetting of the priorities in Toronto, in the Toronto region. The kind of constant criticism, I think, from of how transit is planned in the Toronto area is that every time someone new gets elected at either City Hall or at Queen's Park, kind of flips the switch and kind of reprioritizes what projects should be built. So that was kind of the latest iteration of that, where the city, for instance, had set out their own priorities for which projects should be built. And the Premier kind of came in and shuffled the deck again. So, and again, the kind of biggest thing was that the Relief Line subway was this project that the city had been pursuing for a while, with the help of the province, badly needed to take pressure off the busiest subway line in the country. And the premier came in and replaced that with this Ontario Line project, which would do a similar thing, but would use a different technology and have a different route and that kind of thing. So, you know, they say that they'll use existing plans to make sure that they expedite the Ontario Line. But we're kind of back to the drawing board in terms of the planning stage of that. It's a very early planning stage now.
When you talk about using different technology and slightly different routes, what exactly is the Ontario Line and how is it going to move people?
So the Ontario Line, the province says that they would use this kind of alternate technology. You know, I think listeners hopefully have some idea of what the TDC subway looks like. You know, it's a kind of big underground train. but what the Ontario Line would use a smaller train, and that they haven't quite specified yet. They're hoping the private sector will help them figure out what to actually deploy. But using a smaller train lets them do a couple of things that they say would cut down on the cost of the Ontario Line. So through sections of it, it would be brought above ground on bridges to span the Don River in two places. If you had to tunnel underground, it would be hugely expensive. So they say that by bringing it above ground and certain parts, you could build it faster and you could build it cheaper.
What's the reaction to that been?
So there's been, I guess, mixed reaction. A lot of experts I talked to say it's actually a decent plan. It would serve neighborhoods that, for instance, the old Relief Line plan wouldn't serve, especially some low-income neighborhoods in parts of the city. So they say that that's a pretty big positive. However, what they are doing is part of the route that would go above ground is through pretty stable residential neighborhoods in kind of the east downtown of Toronto. And the kind of conventional, you know, wisdom of transit projects is that you bury transit lines in pretty dense parts of town. But what the province is planning to do is build it above ground through an existing GO Transit rail corridor on some kind of elevated structure and have trains running very quickly, so or very close together. So every 90 seconds in each direction, you'd have one of these smaller trains running. And that has provoked some pushback from people in this residential neighborhood who are kind of concerned about this big elevated structure that no one really knows what it will look like, running through their neighborhoods and having trains running very quickly. And so you're seeing some pushback from residents who had thought that they were going to get this underground subway of the Relief Line, now suddenly have this other project on the cards. And some people are voicing objections to that, the specifics of the plan.
Those are expensive neighborhoods now, right? Like those neighborhoods have kind of exploded in property value, at least.
Yeah. To be honest, I haven't actually looked at a lot of the demographics, I guess, of the neighborhood. But yeah, it's you know, Leslieville and kind of South Riverdale and these areas that are certainly, I think, fair to say, desirable places to live. I think when you have neighborhoods like that where people are kind of concerned with property values and all that kind of thing, the idea of like an elevated rail corridor running nearby is going to spark some alarm.
Yeah. And this is where we kind of change tact on your story from like transit plans to what's Metrolinx doing to change the perception of this line?
Yeah, so the thing that that caught a lot of people's attention, I guess, and I should point out that the CBC's Lauren Pelley, I think, was the first one to report this, but Metrolinx has started to use, not just for the Ontario Line, but for other transit projects as well, use social media influencers to pay them to promote these projects. And they say that this is Metrolinx says this is just the way to reach younger audiences. People aren't consuming media in the same way that they used to. So if you want to reach a young demographic and get those young people riding transit for the rest of their lives and stuff, you want to promote where they're watching. So you go on social media and get these influencers to do that. But I think where it gets a bit prickly is I think they've done it before as part of this whole campaign. They were promoting using social media influencers to promote existing projects, existing transit services. Get on the GO Train. Hey, the GO Train's great.
Right. Get a Presto card. Yeah. It's fun.
Sure. But what they're doing with this is they're promoting the Ontario Line, a project that does not yet exist, that has some controversy around it and has provoked a kind of pushback from locals. So to have kind of regular folks, if you can call social media influencers regular people, kind of post in and saying this is a great project, I'm really looking forward to that, you know, I think it arguably kind of makes it look like there's some local support for a project where perhaps there's, you know, there's been pushback for. So it, I think, strikes some people as problematic for sure.
My name is John Cullen, and I want to tell you a story. It's a story about a scandal, broken relationships, gossip, rumors, money, corporate rivalry, and curling. It's the story of Broomgate, how a single broom, yes, a broom, turned friends into foes and almost killed the 500-year-old sport of curling.
It was a year I'd like to forget.
Broomgate, available now.
Can you pull up on your phone and maybe just describe and read one of the posts?
Yeah, I'll read one.
I just want to know, like, how it comes across.
Right. So this is an influencer who goes by the handle of Kale and Crunches, with a K on Crunches. But her real name's Marley Cohen. Then she's standing in front of a big Leslieville sign with her very cute little baby, and says, and the post says, for someone who was born and raised in Toronto, it's pretty crazy how much of the city I have yet to explore. And she says she always tends to stick to the same areas because traffic has a lot to do with it. And that's why I'm excited about having more public transit options when the Metrolinx Ontario line will be completed. It will make hitting up some of my fave spots like Leslieville way easier without having to account for bumper-to-bumper traffic.
Sure. What's different? I guess what I'm trying to get at here is you kind of drew the parallel between having people, you know, endorse things that already exist mm-hmm. and that, you know, just are like almost education campaigns, which mm-hmm. governments do all the time. Mm-hmm. This isn't that, but governments also buy media all the time to sure. get people on side for big projects.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, just outside of any kind of this context, I think social media influencers are kind of an interesting use of marketing, right? Because it sort of blurs the line between kind of organic opinions expressed on social media and paid advertising, right? These things don't, unless you read down to the end of the post that I just read, for instance, you know, it has the hashtag ad on it.
Okay, so it is marked.
It is marked, yeah, for sure. But if you it's a fairly long post. I think on Instagram, probably most people just look at the photo and mm-hmm. Might read a couple of lines. And so before you get into who's doing the advertising and stuff, I think it kind of blurs the line, right? You're not totally, it doesn't look like advertising right away. But for a public transit agency who has, pledged to consult the public, for instance, on this very project, to kind of make it look like there are people who are sort of organically supporting the project before they're engaging in the consultation, I think kind of provokes some sense that perhaps, you know, they're trying to kind of skew public opinion. You know, I think you could argue perhaps that it looks like astroturfing, right? Like that's the project, that the term used for when organizations pay to fake like grassroots support for whatever project they're supporting. But I should just say that Metrolinx says that, you know, they're not trying to astroturf. They're not trying to make it look like there's more support for the Ontario line than there actually is. They're just saying this is how we get the word out there in this day and age when the kind of media landscape is changing.
What has the reaction been from people learning that Metrolinx is doing this? Like after Lauren Pelly broke mm-hmm. the story, mm-hmm. again, we're coming back to like regular folks, right? But what have Torontonians said about it?
Yeah, I think there's just a lot of consternation. I think some people see the whole idea of social media influencers as kind of a silly thing. I'd be interested to see how effective this kind of marketing is. So some people are saying, you know, why are you spending public dollars on this?
Right.
Should note that Metrolinx has not said how much money they're spending, which, you know, as a public agency, I think they really have an obligation to tell the public how they're spending their money. So, I think it's notable that they have not done that. I think it's also interesting as well that some of the reaction from social media influencers as part of this campaign, several of them took down their posts after all this hit the news or hid their posts.
Really?
Yeah. So you could tell that obviously they were perhaps feeling under the microscope in a way that they maybe hadn't anticipated and didn't want to kind of be subject of that kind of scrutiny and so hid their posts. I understand Metrolinx kind of, you know, prodded them to, to put them back up because they were paid for. So I think that perhaps shows that even the people involved in the campaign had some kind of like unease about it.
Has the city of Toronto gotten involved with the province kind of trying to lay the groundwork here?
Not really. I mean, the province has really moved to, they now have like legislative authority to take over new transit expansion projects in Toronto. They can legally force the TTC, for instance, to stop any work they're doing on a transit planning project. So, yeah, so the city and TTC are kind of taking a back seat. You know, they say that they're working with Metrolinx and everything, but certainly Metrolinx is in the driver's seat here.
Has anyone from the city commented about the influencer strategy?
I mean, so I spoke to a local councillor who represents the constituents who have these concerns about the Ontario Line. And yeah, she basically said that she felt it was disingenuous, I believe. And you know, you can see how when people are calling her office and saying, we're not a fan of this project, to see someone post in with a big Leslieville sign in the background and saying, you know, this is a great project. Mm-hmm. She's kind of, there's a disconnect there from her perspective, I think.
Is this kind of advertising, influencer-based political ads in particular, something that we know how to grapple with yet? Because after reading your story, I'm just thinking of all the ways in which parties could use influencers in a way that would feel really weird.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm not an advertising expert, but I think it is a kind of thing where, I don't know, any kind of advertising requires some literacy, right, on the part of the public. To try to, you know, to interpret it and whatever. So, you know, I'm not sure how accustomed we are to public agencies and government agencies using this kind of marketing and whether, you know, the public kind of interprets that a different way than private companies. But yeah, I do think, you know, the public agencies have a responsibility to do marketing, I think, in a different way than private agencies, right? I mean, they're supposed to be representing the public interest. So anything that looks like they're kind of trying to skew public opinion, I think gets into kind of a gray area that I don't know that we kind of know how to grapple with. But it is an odd thing. And I think probably Metrolinx feels that they're on kind of the cutting edge here, right? Like Metrolinx is sort of likes to operate as a business, I think, to some extent. Mm-hmm. They kind of have put a lot of emphasis on business principles. So perhaps they feel that this is kind of sort of forward thinking commercial outlook that they have here. But obviously the public has some different opinions.
From their point of view, I can see why they might do it. It must cost a lot less than buying TV time or billboard time.
Yeah.
And you're reaching, I mean, we talk all the time on this podcast because it's a podcast about reaching people that aren't in the traditional spaces for advertising.
Yeah, I would wonder how effective this stuff is though, right? In the sense that, you know, so the post that we were talking about earlier had a lot of likes, had like thousands of likes on it, but it also had like a really cute baby in like a fashionable teddy onesie, and you know, the baby's mother who's also dressed well and is a good looking young woman, and so, you know, a lot of the likes and a lot of the comments, I don't think you know, I didn't look at all of them, but they weren't like, this is a well thought out transit project. They were like, you look so cute and your baby looks so cute.
Yeah,
so it's like there's a lot of attention to it, but is that you know, swaying people's minds towards this project in a way that traditional advertising wouldn't or something? Like, I'd be interested to see, yeah, like, what are the metrics on this? Like, do they, I don't know if Metrolinx has some internal study or anything that says this kind of thing is effective, but I'd certainly be interested to see the numbers on that.
In the meantime, what do they do next? You mentioned we're a little ways away from shovels in the ground,
yeah, for sure.
But does anything have to pass for this plan to go ahead, or do they just have to kind of consult and move along?
There's certain legislation that they have to follow in terms of getting projects built and consulting with people and kind of boxes they have to tick. But as I say, the province is kind of in the driver's seat here, and they want to open this thing by 2027, which is a hugely aggressive timeline that a lot of experts say is not possible. I haven't heard any experts say that it is possible. So they're, you know, they've said that they will do some consultation with the local neighborhood, the several neighborhoods involved, but I think they're going to move as quickly as they possibly can to get things built.
As someone who's covered probably a bunch of them, can you imagine what those public consultations will be like?
Yeah, I think you'll hear the concerns that I was talking about earlier with people saying, you know, that they don't want this thing through parts of their neighborhood. We had a bit of a preview of that when this these plans went to City Hall a couple months ago, and yeah, the meeting was packed with, you know, there's pretty organized effort, it looks like, from people in Leslieville and surrounding neighborhoods to voice their concerns about the kind of technology that's being used here. But yeah, I think there are some neighborhoods, of course, that support it as well. Residents are promised greater access to transit. So obviously mm-hmm. lots of people want that. But yeah, those meetings tend to be, you sort of hear the same thing at these meetings, right? The people say, I'm not against transit, but I don't like this particular plan and how it's going to affect my house and my neighborhood and whatever. So I expect we'll hear a lot of that.
And meanwhile, the city is desperate for any kind of transit.
Yeah, for sure. It's a difficult thing with this one. As a reporter, you know, we don't, yeah, I think a lot of people, some readers of these stories, I think, look at the people who object to the plans as NIMBYs, as people who say, not in my backyard. And I think certainly there are some, I think, in cases like this, that can be a fair kind of criticism. As you say, we need transit and someone's going to have to be inconvenienced by it. But I would just say that this is what strikes me as kind of interesting about this is that this corridor that they're going to build the Ontario line through was already slated to be have a lot of transit upgrades happening to it. The GO trains are going to run much more frequently, going to electrify the lines. There's going to be a lot of construction. There's going to be a lot of train activity. And then on top of that pretty big project, they're piggybacking this other transit project, the Ontario Line. So it's a lot of activity going on in a pretty concentrated and stable neighborhood. So I think it's a slightly different situation than perhaps we've seen in other cases. I think that accounts for some of the degree of pushback, but perhaps that pushback would be there kind of no matter what.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
Ben Spurr is the transportation reporter at the Toronto Star. That was The Big Story. If you'd like more, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. If you'd like something a little different, head to frequencypodcastnetwork.com or thegravytrainpodcast.com. You can also find us on Twitter at frequencypods or at thebigstoryfpn. And you can find all of our podcasts in whichever podcast player you happen to prefer. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.
My name is John Cullen, and I want to tell you a story. It's a story about a scandal, broken relationships, gossip, rumors, money, corporate rivalry, and curling. It's the story of Broomgate, how a single broom, yes, a broom, turned friends into foes and almost killed the 500-year-old sport of curling.
It was a year I'd like to forget.
Broomgate, available now.